The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs. I'm the Associate Director of Author Events here, and I'm honored to introduce our guest this evening. A longtime staff writer for The New Yorker, Lawrence Wright is the author of one novel and nine nonfiction books, including the masterwork, The Looming Tower, a consistently revealing page-turner that explains the rise of Islamic fundamentalism and the intelligence mistakes that led to the 9/11 attacks. Variously reviewed as magisterial, indispensable, and beautifully crafted, the book went on to become a national bestseller and winner of the Pulitzer Prize. A member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Society of American Historians, he has written and performed two one-man plays, produced the Emmy-winning documentary Going Clear, and is currently producing a television series based on The Looming Tower. In 10 watershed pieces first published in The New Yorker, his new book charts the course of Middle East terrorism since the 1990s. He'll be in conversation tonight with Dick Pullman, writer in residence at the University of Pennsylvania and national political columnist at WHYY's newsworks.org. Please welcome Lawrence Wright and Dick Pullman to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Well, on behalf of the Free Library, thanks everybody for coming. This is Larry Wright, as you can tell. I'm just so happy to see so many people here in the middle of July. I mean, that's pretty amazing, which yeah. I think is a testament to your good work. So, bravo.
Well, it's kind of miserable outside. They're just coming in for the air conditioning.
You can't go down the shore all the time. Yeah. So what we're going to do, some of you have been here before, I'm sure, for these events. Larry and I are going to talk informally for a short bit of time, well, about maybe 25, 30 minutes. And then we'll break for questions from you all. And there will be people with microphones when that happens. And so we'll just try to, you know, segue smoothly from part one to part two. And I have the questions I have actually kind of fall into two categories. We'll probably oscillate between the two categories. One is, you know, the content of the book about the war on terror. That's sort of category one. Category two is actually just about how you do the work, you know, mm-hmm. the work of a journalist covering the war on terror, because I think there are probably, you know, I think people might be interested to know how do such pieces get put together, reported, and written. But I want to open up actually just with, I think, one of the big picture questions that we need to just go to right away, which is that based on, you know, you've seen the war on terror from the American intelligence side and from the side of people in the Middle East, you know, the Muslims right. in the community, and you've tracked it through the years. How, as Americans, how safe are we at this point?
Oh, well, I think we're just at the early stages of the age of terror. You know, I don't mean to be discouraging, but if you could look back and think, when did terrorism begin, modern terrorism? Well, we would date it to the Palestinian diaspora in 1948. And the entire population of the Palestinian diaspora was 750,000 people. And just think about how much misery they've endured and how much misery other people have endured because of the terrorism that came out of that movement. Well, right now, there are 5 million Syrians who are, you know, out of their country. They're refugees. There's no single cause of terror. You can't say that poverty or the lack of education or gender apartheid or political instability or tyranny or any of those things that people list as the causes of terror are the one thing. If we could just take care of that, then we would eliminate terror. I think of them just as being tributaries in this great river of despair that flows through the Middle East. And those refugee camps are a tremendous repository of despair. And left unattended, I think we're in for trouble. Half of those refugees, according to UNESCO, are children, and only 20% of them have been getting an education. So if you were a five-year-old child in 2011 when the revolution began, you've already lost your elementary school education. So what kind of future awaits you? And I don't mean to just pin it on the Syrians. We're in the middle of the greatest refugee stream since World War II. The Afghans, the Iraqis, the Nigerians, you know, the world is a flood in uprooted people. And it's going to cause a lot of problems in the future. And marry that to these technological developments that make it so much easier for small groups or even individuals to have potent and fatal impact. That really does concern me.
Do you feel that the, or you have any indication from what you've watched in terms of American politics in the last 6 or 7 months, that the Trump administration has a better or lesser handle on what's going on than its predecessor? I asked that as straightforwardly as I possibly could. No adverbs, nothing.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your straight face. You know, one thing that we need in this war on terror is allies, and we're losing them at a rapid clip. I'm really concerned about that. Europe is becoming very distrustful of us, and we need Europe, and Europe needs us. Europe is really in peril, and we have to be close to our allies. But I also think that there's one thing I think the Trump administration doesn't get is that the people who are fighting against the terrorists in the Middle East are Muslims. You know, they are Iraqis, they're Jordanians, they're Turks, they're Kurds. These are the people who are fighting against ISIS and against Al-Qaeda. And if you stigmatize Muslims altogether, then you're alienating the very people who are doing the work we want to have done there.
I'm curious to people get into journalism in all different kinds of ways and for all different kinds of reasons, and not necessarily when they're 21, it could be later. What sparked your interest in the Middle East? I mean, you covered a little bit of this in the preface of the book upstairs.
Right.
What drew you in particular to the region and the issues?
It was entirely an accident. I was a conscientious objector during Vietnam, and out of Dallas, Texas. I didn't even expect I would be granted a conscientious objector status, but I had to serve 2 years of alternative service, and it had to be 50 miles from home, which was fine with me. I wanted to get out of America. I was just sick of the whole discussion about Vietnam, and had to pay very little, and it had to be in the interest of the United States. So I went to the United Nations thinking they would give me a job far, far away and pay me very little. And they said, no, we don't do that, but there's a list of American institutions abroad. And one of them, the American University in Cairo, had an office across the street, at 866 UN Plaza. So I walked across the street. I didn't know that we didn't have any diplomatic relations with Egypt. I didn't know that the president of the university was a CIA agent. There are only a couple hundred Americans in the whole country. I'm not even sure I knew what language they spoke in Egypt. But I walked across the street, and 30 minutes later, they said, well, can you leave tonight? No, my girlfriend's back in Boston. I haven't told my parents what I'm doing. Can you leave tomorrow? Oh, yeah, I can go tomorrow. So the next morning, I got on a flight to Cairo and arrived at midnight, and I taught my first class the next morning. And that was my brilliant introduction to the Arab world. I loved that period. Honestly, it was one of the dearest periods in my life. I loved teaching. I loved those kids. They were very dear to me. And so it was sad to me, really emotionally wrenching, after 9/11, to find that a culture that I was as fond of as I was of Egypt was attacking the culture that I'm a part of.
So when did you sense a facility for journalism during this period or before that? I mean, you were teaching and you were exposed to the culture. So somewhere along the line, it sort of got married with reporting and writing.
You know, when I was in college, I wanted to be a writer with a capital W. You know, yeah. I thought I would be a poet in Greenwich Village. I don't even like poetry, you know, but nor did I have any idea about the real estate values in Greenwich Village. So, but you know, I just had the idea that I was going to be a writer, and when I came back to the United States, the lesson I learned was that people will pay you to write journalism. People will pay you to find out information that's useful. And I thought it was a bridge to another career. But what it was a great teacher for me. Even though I'd had this experience of living in the Middle East, and I was still a very naive young man. And I think journalism is the greatest education for anybody. You are entitled to go out and talk to people. You have a passport into other people's lives, and it exposes you to the rest of humanity. It would be a great thing, I think, if there were more kids that were allowed to have an internship or something like that for a year or two before they go on to the rest of their careers, because you learn that the world is not just you, that there are people that don't agree with you, they have reasons for it, they have different experiences, and I think it matures you, and I think it naturally it causes you to develop some kind of compassion that may be residual, but once you've seen how other people live and the struggles they have, then I don't think you can ever retreat entirely into that shell of complacency that so many people live in.
Did you discover or during that period, or maybe it's certainly since when you've been doing these pieces for The New Yorker, are you ever surprised at this point that how many people just like to talk about themselves and want to tell you their stories, even if they're people who have absolutely no cultural affinity with you?
It's always a mystery why people talk to reporters. But I think everybody wants to have their story told. And most people believe that they're doing the right thing. And if they could only have a sympathetic listener. And the other thing you can't discount is the people that have heard these stories, their family, their friends, they're tired of it. And here comes a fresh listener, who's really interested, and it's hard to resist for a lot of people. But, sometimes you, as a reporter, I think you'd have to just suspend judgment for a while you're listening, because you sometimes hear things that are horrifying. And, when I was working on The Looming Tower, and I had the fantasy that I might interview bin Laden, who was still alive and had actually given interviews, I thought, if I had that opportunity, should I kill him? And it was never entirely resolved, because there was a duty to humanity on the one hand, and then a duty to who I am and my career. But it really did cross my mind, because I would love to interview him, but I would be very happy to see him dead.
Mm-hmm. So this was something I was thinking about. There was something in the book that made me ask this question, and you just prompt me to remember it. Who would be, in all the time that you did that book, and certainly these New Yorker pieces that are in this collection, which terrorist, or maybe more like terrorist sympathizer, was the most memorable that you really had to, you probably heard some stuff that was like, oh my God, but you were doing the job of having to record who they were and to chronicle what they were about, and you did have to do some kind of suspension of judgment. Is there anybody?
Well,
in particular
what comes
to mind?
It's not exactly what you're asking, but Bin Laden spent 4 years in Sudan from '92 to '96. They were very significant years, and we were the ones that chased him out of Sudan. It was a terrible mistake, but while he was there, he was a businessman, and so I went to Sudan. And I went into Khartoum, and I was pressing these Sudanese intelligence agents that I had hooked up with to help me meet some of the Qaeda guys there that had worked with Bin Laden. And they were willing to drive me around and show me Bin Laden's house and stuff like that, but they were very reluctant to give me the goods. But one day, I'm in my hotel room, and I should preface this by saying that I had back trouble. And I was in all this travel, I had a lot of back pain. And you know those balls that you blow up and sit on? It's a lot of trouble to blow them up and unblow them when you're traveling internationally. And so I was sitting on one of those balls. And there's a knock on my door, and it's one of these Sudanese agents, and he's got this guy with him who's this pudgy character with one of those conical Indonesian hats like Sukarno or somebody used to wear. And so they come into the room, and the intelligence agent is really sleepy. His eyes are bobbing. And I said, well, Ahmed, just lie down on the bed, immediately snoring, and leaving me with this Al-Qaeda guy. And I said, so who are you? What's your name? And he said, well, you can call me Loe. Okay. And so he sat down in the chair, and he was amazing. He knew everything. He was a font of information about Bin Laden. And he also had this weird sense of humor. He was constantly cracking jokes. He was saying, so, Osama would tell me, I'm going to form this group of Muslims and we're going to go fight all over the world. And I said, how are you going to get them there? Air France? Ha, ha, ha. He'd slap his knee. And this is the face of Al-Qaeda. And I came back to America, and I thought, who was that guy? All I knew, he spoke English. His middle name was Loe, or his name was Loe, that's all. And I found in the archives the name Muhammad Loe Bayazid. And his Al-Qaeda name was Abarida al-Suri. And he was the guy who took the notes the day that Al-Qaeda was founded, 29 years ago next week. And so I had to go back to Sudan now that I knew, who he was. And I went back and he wouldn't see me. And that was frustrating. So I went back a third time and he finally agreed to see me again. And I said, Loe, it's a lot of trouble to come to Khartoum. Why didn't you see me last time? And he said, well, I didn't know how to seriously to take you. The first time we met, you were sitting on a balloon.
There's humor in everything.
Yeah.
There was a line in the book about, I think I wrote it down here. Oh, right. You said that the Middle East, you called the Middle East paradise for reporters.
Yeah.
And I think that's Probably because, you know, the conflicts, it's so rich and in the history. And it, the,
and yeah. people talk.
And yeah. people talk. You said it was paradise for reporters, except when it's, quote, a lethal trap. And, you know, the most affecting article in this collection, I think, is the very last one about the four American hostages yeah. And the books dedicated to them.
Yeah.
Do you have rules for yourself when you're over there reporting about how to avoid lethal traps?
Well, when I was there, it wasn't that dangerous. And there, I still felt that there was a zone of invulnerability encircling me as a reporter, that people respected that. But I did take some precautions. But, you know, I didn't carry a gun or anything. I just, you know, I sometimes changed cars or, you know. Mm. But the only time I really felt that I wasn't certain that I could trust my instincts was in Pakistan, which is, to me, the most unnerving country of all to work in. And the day I got off the plane, I interviewed Khaled Hawaja, who Marianne Pearl holds responsible, was partly responsible for Danny Pearl's death. He was the first American to get beheaded by Khaled Sheikh Mohammed in that case. But Khaled had been telling people that Danny was Jewish. And he came to my hotel room and he said, well, I would really like to invite you to my house, but if you get killed, I'll really be in trouble. So I was grateful that I didn't pursue it. But he turned out to be a terrific source. And that's why Danny had cultivated him. You know, you have to take people where they are. I try not to think too much about those things because the paranoia can stand in front of you and your ability to get the story that you want. Mm-hmm. But after 9/11, it was a lonely feeling because the whole Middle East seemed to have been depopulated of Westerners almost immediately.
Mm-hmm. You know, another different kind of occupational hazard in this era, I think, was something that you talked about in the book. I think you added this to one of the pieces. This was in the piece about McConnell. I'm blanking. Yeah. I keep
Mike
thinking
McConnell,
Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
Mike McConnell. Thank you. The counterterrorism chief.
Yeah, he was the director
Bush.
Of National Intelligence.
Director of National Intelligence. All right. So you talked to him about the fact that you found out that your phone had been tapped.
Yeah.
This was while you're working in America.
Right.
Right, making calls overseas.
Yeah.
Right? That you realized your phone had been tapped by American intelligence.
Yeah.
They were capturing stuff. There was a term for that, which I can't remember, which did not please you. And you talked about it in the book, and you confronted him with that, which was really interesting. How did you find out, unless I missed this, as I might have, how did you find out that your phone had been tapped?
Well, the first thing that happened is that Ayman al-Zawahiri is now the head of al-Qaeda, and I had written about him. And one of his relatives called me to ask if Zawahiri's children were still alive, because they didn't know.
Right.
And I said, I don't know, but I'll ask around. And I called the case agent and the FBI for Zawahiri, and he said, no, they're all dead, which turned out to be wrong, as so often is the case. And I called the relative back, and I said, I'm sorry to tell you that the children are dead. And a day or two later, I was talking to a source in Alex Station, which was the CIA's Bin Laden station. And I said I'd had this conversation with Zawahiri's cousin. He said, yeah, I saw that. And And at the time, I thought, it's those Egyptians. You know, they're up on the Zawahiri's phones and so on. So I wouldn't be surprised. But what he said was that he saw a digest of it. And, you know, that rang a bell because the NSA doesn't release transcripts. They typically release digests of, you know, with a conversation. And it seemed like a little trouble for the Egyptians to go through. And then one day, the FBI, Joint Terrorism Task Force, we have them all over the country now, 56 of them, and they wanted to come. It was an FBI agent and a member of the Food and Drug Administration. And they wanted to come interview me. And I had talked to the FBI mainly to educate them about Al-Qaeda. So I thought that that's what they were coming from. But no, they had a list of telephone calls that had been made from my phone. And and they were interested in a 44207 number. And I said, it's a business number in London. And they said, can you tell us who it is? I said, you don't know? It belonged to a barrister in London who represented a lot of jihadis that I'd been talking to. And anyway, then they asked me, who is Caroline Wright? Because that's who they thought was making the calls. And it's our daughter. And she was, you know, in college, you know, but the way that they do a link chart on the no-fly list and stuff like that is Caroline is linked to the lawyer who is linked to Al-Qaeda. Two steps, you know. And I said, well, how'd you get my daughter's name? Because none of our phones are in her name. And then they packed up their briefcases and walked off. Mm. So I put two and two together at that point. And I figured that's how they were. I was working Al-Qaeda, and they were working Al-Qaeda by working me.
So is this just the cost of doing business now, if you want to be a journalist doing these international stories like this?
It's been so weird because after, you know, a few years after 9/11, all the journalists, you know, the investigative reporter friends of mine, and I was too, using throwaway phones and stuff like drug dealers. And what we're doing is hiding from our own government.
I know you talk in the book a little bit about trying to strike the proper balance between, obviously we need to be more vigilant. You know, we want the government, we want our agencies to protect us, but we don't want to lose our civil liberties. And so, right. You know, you kind of had a personal experience right at that uneasy juncture there. Is there a proper balance that has eluded us so far where we can be more vigilant and yet at the same time not give up our values? Is there a sweet spot we haven't found yet?
Well, you know, I was thinking, you know, last time I was in Philadelphia, I went to see the Liberty Bell. And to go see the Liberty Bell, I suppose it's still true now, you have to take off your shoes and your belt. And I thought, this is weird, you know. Now, every time you go into an office building, you get your picture made and so on. And I know these seem like small sacrifices, but they're impingements on our liberty. And I got to thinking about what we've lost as a country since we've been in the war on terror. And I can see a lot of you remember the way the country was before 9/11, but you know, people that are younger don't know. And I close this book with this this memory I had of in high school. I was fortunate to have a girlfriend, but I was not fortunate to have enough money to take her out on a date. So we went to the airport in Dallas, and it's called Love Field. And back then, you know, we could walk out on the tarmac. Some international jetliner had come in, and so we walked up into the plane and sat in the first class cabin, and a stewardess, as we called them then, came in, and she gave us a snack, and we pretended to be international sophisticates. And then we went back into the airport and went up into the FAA tower and opened the door. Hey, kids, come on in. And we sat there and watched them landing the planes. And I think about how that America is dead. But if it's, and terrorism killed it. But if it's forgotten, we won't remember to steer back to that. And that's what I fear that we're losing, is the sense of the personal freedom that we once had in this country before terrorism changed who we are.
I'm going to cut off my own questions at this point. That went fast. We've got 30 minutes left to play here. So we've got people with microphones. We're going to call on you guys.
Very much enjoying tonight. I wanted to ask you, which Western country do you think is doing the most profound and best job at responding to terrorism? You mentioned both. Well, I guess
it's... Okay.
That's a good one.
It's a... There are two ways of answering this. One could say that America is doing the best job because the strikes haven't been nearly as severe as frequent as they are in Western Europe. On the other hand, we're really, really fortunate in the Muslim community that we have in this country. The average Muslim in America is as well educated. Makes as much money as the average American, is far less likely to go to prison than the average American. And you compare that to France, where you have 60%, the Muslim population is about 10 to 12%. 60% of the prisoners are Muslim. Can you imagine what a measure of alienation that is? And moreover, prison is the most dangerous place for people to go in terms of becoming radicalized. Man, if there's one thing I could eliminate, in this whole radicalization program, I would make sure that people are dispersed and, that they're not exposed in these cliques where they spend years talking each other up. And then they come out of prison full, their heads are completely changed. In that sense, Europe has a far greater challenge. And the country that is probably most challenged right now is Germany. It's interesting because the Muslim population in Germany, until this recent immigration onslaught, was largely Turkish. And with the early bombings in France and Paris, it was odd that the Muslim population in Germany was so quiescent, and that changed. But it's going to be difficult for Germany, but they are really good, and I think that their capacity to oversee their population, the infringements on civil liberties, are just something that comes along with taking the risk that that they have.
Could you comment on the European colonization of the Middle East that happened after the fall of the Ottoman Empire?
Well, this is the legacy that that so many European countries are living with. And if you spend time in the Middle East, you'll hear about the Sykes-Picot Treaty again and again, which is the agreement between the Brits and the French to divide the Ottoman Empire up between the two of them. And the imperialistic thinking of that era is just kind of hard to recapture. But a lot of the impetus for people who are drawn into the conflict in Syria and Iraq is to erase those lines that were drawn, those artificial borders that were drawn after the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the end of World War I. the colonization legacy that France had, for instance, in Algeria. So many Algerians moved into France, and but they were never entirely absorbed into that country. And they live in these banlieues, these little suburbs, oftentimes outside of cities. And you know, the unemployment rate is terrible, and it's a chronic problem. And the French have done a terrible job of absorbing them into their culture. But that's not just true of France. You know, like Belgium, there's a real hotbeds in Belgium, and the number one name for a child born in Belgium today is Mohammed. So, you know, these are countries that feel threatened, existentially threatened by their, you know, by the large Muslim populations, by their high birth rate, and by their extreme alienation from the culture.
My question is sort of specific. It's about a guy named Saif al-Adil. Now, I just want to preface this by saying I haven't read your new book yet, but my question
is... Are you
is,
Saif al-Adil?
Is that yeah.
It? Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So my question is about some of the disagreements that bin Laden and Zarqawi have had, and particularly sort of about the back and forth between them regarding the sectarian split kind of stuff. And one of the things that sort of interested me is that these are two guys who, from what I understand, did not like each other at all, particularly because like the first time Zarqawi meets bin Laden, he starts yelling about having to kill all the Shiites, and bin Laden's mother is an Alawite. And if it's not for this guy, Saif al-Adil, then these two people may not have ever sort of reconciled those differences and come together to take the JTJ yeah. to the Al-Qaeda franchise. So my question is, what did bin Laden actually think about Shiites? Because he clearly does not like them. It says in your book, that The Looming Tower, that he didn't like them. But he had a different sort of opinion than bin Laden, or than Zarqawi.
Than Zarqawi. Well, as a little preface of this, when I was working on The Looming Tower, I was puzzled. I could see that Al-Qaeda was essentially an Egyptian organization with a Saudi head on it. And but where were the Jordanians and the Palestinians and the Lebanese and the Syrians, you know, the part of the Middle East that we call the Levant or Al-Sham in Arabic? There were some, but there weren't very many. And so I started poking around a little bit, and I found out that there had been another training camp in Afghanistan after Al-Qaeda got started there that was run by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And he was a kind of competitor to bin Laden. Bin Laden gave him some money, $5,000, and he invited him to join Al-Qaeda, but Zarqawi didn't do that at that time. And they were really very different men. Bin Laden was an international businessman, and Zarqawi was a criminal. You know, he was a street thug. He was a rapist, and he had an arm covered with tattoos, which when he got after he got religion, he cut off with a knife. And Bin Laden had a dream of expelling the West from the Muslim countries and establishing Islam as the world's only superpower. And Zarqawi was, and then finally he would establish the caliphate. And Zarqawi reversed that. He wanted to establish the caliphate right away. And his organization eventually became ISIS. He also wanted to fight in Iraq, which was totally puzzling to bin Laden, because Iraq is a largely Shiite country, and Al-Qaeda is an entirely Sunni organization. Now, bin Laden saw the Sunnis as not being real Muslims, but Zarqawi wanted to purify the religion by starting a civil war between the Sunnis and the Shias, which he did. In a way, that's what we're looking at in this overarching war. You see so many conflicts in the Middle East, but in some way, many of them are tied to this larger civil war. And, you know, bin Laden lost control. I don't think on his own that he would ever have decided to wage a war against the Shiites. And Zawahiri, Ayman al-Zawahiri, sent a letter to Zarqawi at one point saying, do you have to kill them all? You know, and why don't you just shoot them? Do you have to behead them? You know, they were all offended by the by the techniques that ISIS was using.
Could you comment on the leadership in our anti-terrorist organizations in the current government and whether they are more or less effective than under the Obama administration?
Well, they haven't had very much time to work. You know, the new director of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, you know, I just don't have enough information right now to answer the question. So far, we haven't done anything different. You know, the policy that the Obama administration had essentially was containment. And that's a good policy when you don't have a plan. And that's pretty much where we are right now. I think, you know, there are things that can be done. That the government could certainly be working harder on enlisting our allies in fighting in Iraq and Syria. It's surprising to me that, for instance, the Jordanians haven't been involved. I think the Turks could, if they could get rid of their maniacal fixation on the Kurds, they have a very powerful military force. They could be a tremendous help to us. But they're right now so alienated from the United States, it's hard to see how we're going to be able to enlist them as reliable allies.
Are this, just by the way, before we go back to the question, are the CIA and the FBI getting along better now than they used to? Are they cooperating more than they used to? And the reason I ask is because the book really makes clear, or reminded me anyway, about how before 9/11, the CIA had some very crucial information about at least one of the 9/11 conspirators who was actually already in the States, and there was a cell here. Right. And they withheld the information from the FBI for what, 15, 16 months?
Yeah.
Something like that. And you were, you know, in the book very harshly critical about it. They've never apologized for it. Are they cooperating more now? Is that
thing? There have been structural changes in the intelligence community since 9/11. And one of the most notable is the creation of the National Counterterrorism Center, the NCTC, which was, by the way, designed by Disney Imagineering. And it happens that a friend of mine worked there. She happened to have been a movie producer at Disney Studios. And we had lunch at the NCTC, and she said that the chairs, even in the commissary, are the same in the Disney, except without the mouse ears. But it's not a comment on their competence.
It's not a Mickey Mouse operation.
No, exactly. Okay. It's not. Right. The ears are gone. But if you can envision, you know, there are 16 intelligence agencies, not counting the director of the national intelligence that oversees all of it, and they have representatives in this place, and they have, you know, like booths sitting around, and there's a big screen where, when I visited, they were watching Fox News, and they are forced to be close to each other. It doesn't mean that things don't get through. They do. And if you remember the Detroit bomber, Abu Matalib, I think, forgotten his last name, but the guy that was trying to set off the underwear bomb, his father was one of the richest men in Nigeria and had gone to the CIA and said, my son is a terrorist, essentially. Mm-hmm. And they never turned that information in, and had it not been for some passengers on the airplane, that plane might have blown up.
In your book, The Looming Tower, you talk about a character whose last name is O'Neill.
Yeah, John O'Neill.
Could you talk about him a bit, please?
Oh, yeah, I'd be happy to.
One of the pieces in this collection, too.
After 9/11, if you remember, the planes were grounded for some period of time. And I was in Austin, Texas, and I was dying to find a way to write about, get involved in what I saw as the most important story of our lifetime. And so I began reading obituaries that were streaming online. And on the Washington Post site, there was this obituary of John O'Neill. And he had been head of counterterrorism for the FBI in New York. Ironically, I had written this movie, The Siege, with Denzel Washington and Annette Bening, and Denzel played the head of counterterrorism in New York's FBI office. So this was the guy that I had in some ways imagined. And the obituary made it seem as if he was a disgrace, because he'd been washed out of the bureau for taking classified information out of the office. And then he got a job as the head of security at the World Trade Center. And so I read the obituary and I thought, so instead of getting Bin Laden got him. And I thought, how ironic. But the more I learned about him, I realized it was an irony. John O'Neill was one of the very few people in the country who understood the threat that Al-Qaeda posed to America, even in his own bureau. Very few people took Al-Qaeda seriously. And he was maniacal on the subject and created a lot of enemies because of his dedication to trying to get Bin Laden. When he got the job at the Trade Center, his friend said, John, you'll be safe now, because you know they already bombed the Trade Center. In 1993, a radical Islamist group had bombed the World Trade Center, killed 7 people. And he said, no, they'll come back to finish the job. So he instinctively placed himself at ground zero. That day, he got safely out of the office and then went back in. And to me, it's the opposite of irony. It's a Greek tragedy. He was a amazing man, very flawed. We're making a television series right now at a Looming Tower, and Jeff Daniels is playing John O'Neill, and Alec Baldwin is George Tenet. So,
anybody playing George W. Bush?
No, there's a level at which we go into documentary. So, you know, if you see George Bush or somebody like that, then that would be the real George Bush. Yeah.
There's a view held by some people that Islam is incompatible with democracy. And after the failures of the Arab Spring, that view is seemingly increasing. Do you have a view about whether Islam is compatible or incompatible with democracy?
Well, you know, there are different factors at work. You know, if you look at the Arab world, and if you look at Islam only through the lens of the Arab world, you could draw that conclusion. You know, it's not so clear when you bring in things like Indonesia and Malaysia, and Indonesia's the largest Arab, largest Muslim country in the world. Pakistan, you know, is kind of a family democracy, if I can be kind. But the Arab world, on the other hand, there's something really wrong there. And I remember I went back to Cairo in 1998. It was during the primary season in the presidential election. And this woman at Cairo University, I'm making a speech there where Barack Obama would be making that historic outreach speech to the Muslim world. And she said, "What happened to us?" And I think I understood what she meant, because when I taught there, 20-something years before, Egypt was just one of the underdeveloped countries. It was on the par with South Korea and Thailand and Malaysia and in India. All these countries took off. And Egypt did not, nor did most of the Arab world. And if you look at the Arab world from Morocco to the Persian Gulf, it's about the size of the United States. And it's from one end to the other. There are tyrannies and sham democracies. And I was so hopeful. I think when that young woman asked me that question, I think a few years later she must have been in Tahrir Square trying to bring change to her country. But that revolution also failed. So, I don't know. One thing you learn from spending a lot of time in the Middle East is that things can always get worse.
Thank you. What is your feeling about Syria? I mean, do you see a role for the United States in Syria? Do you think Assad can be toppled? And, I heard a statement by one news broadcaster, or actually a person in security, that Assad has won that civil war. What are your feelings, general viewers? I know it's a broad question, but...
I went to Syria about a year before the Arab Spring, and the reason I went was it was so quiet. As I said, I love the Middle East because they're just everybody talks, and so. And then I thought, there's another country out there, and you never hear anything from it. And so I went to the editor of the New Yorker, David Remnick, and I said, I'd like to go to Syria. It's really quiet. That's not a story, And I thought, well, people know America through our movies. So I'll go to Syria and I'll watch their movies and I'll talk to their filmmakers. And what did I find? Physical abuse. It was the most common element. Everybody I met had been beaten by their parents or their teachers or the cops. It's just the most ordinary thing. It was a common theme in all the movies. And it was the most secular country in that Arab country I'd been in also. It was very odd to me. And but people were truly under the thumb of a tyrant. And I don't know if the culture produced the tyrant or the tyrant produced the culture. But the abuse was, rampant all the way through. And there are stories I could tell you. I'll tell you one, but just as a cautionary tale about the kind of culture that we get involved in. When I wrote about that heartbreaking story about the American hostages, one thing I didn't write, there was a girlfriend of one of the American hostages who was Syrian, an Alawite, the same sect as the Assad family. And her father was very close to the regime. And she ran away to join the revolution. And her father said, if you don't come home, I'm going to kill your mother. And she didn't come home, and he killed her mother. Now, I don't say that that represents all of Syria, and certainly not all of the Arab world. I don't think of the Arab world as being that abusive a place. But again and again, I ran into these stories about a highly traumatized culture before the Civil War ever began. And when we, as a naive country such as we are, wade into these other cultures with so little understanding of what we're facing, it's not surprising to me that we fail. If our goal is to change the culture, then we have to understand what we're getting into. And I think that's, we've done a very poor job of that, in part because of our intelligence community and in part because our press is so enfeebled now. When we were young reporters, there were bureaus all over the world. And that was the best form of intelligence. People lived there. They partied there. They knew the people. They spoke the languages. And that's pretty much eliminated now. So our roots of intelligence, both public and private, have been torn up.
Yeah, I was a foreign correspondent for 3 years in that bureau.
Yeah.
I was in London that bureau's gone.
Yeah.
Can't afford it anymore.
Right. So people parachute in, like me, and you know, you try to get a sense of the place, but you can't really know if you haven't been there, if you haven't spoken the language. You know, you're only trying to get a piece of it.
Considering the risk factors for terrorism and the reasons terrorists give to rationalize it, can you explain why American blacks have never become terrorists?
Well, we've had moments of, you know, real violent uprisings in, you know, Black Panthers and stuff like that in our history. But as I said, it's not, when you start talking about causes of terror, it's not one thing. It's not the absence. I guess if I'm going to get to the real answer to that, I think is that in our country you can change things, and things have changed. You know, I began my career as a reporter for the Race Relations Reporter in Nashville, covering the civil rights movement. The greatest thing that happened in our country since the end of the Civil War. And people have seen nonviolent social change in this country. In order to have the kind of terrorist movement that we're talking about in Syria and this sort of thing, you need to have some sort of community support. If you don't have that, if the community doesn't embrace you, tacitly at least, then you don't have the nurture that you need to recruit and bring new people into your group. And I can't prove it, but I think when I was making that speech in Cairo in 1998, and all these young people were so fixated on the American election. And so I finally asked them, you know, well, if you could vote in America, how many here would vote for Hillary Clinton and all these girls in hijab? And how many for Barack Obama? You know, everybody else. How many for John McCain? One guy from the embassy. but I think the example that we set, I think we underestimate, you know, how powerful that example we have in the world. Nonviolent social change. That's what they wanted when they went into Tahrir Square. I think they were inspired by the American example, and they were crushed by the Egyptian reality.
I'm going to just ask two very, very quick questions. We'll call it a lightning round before we finish up. And this is just one I've just been dying to ask someone in your position who's written nonfiction about the war on terror. There are a number of novelists working, ex-journalists, who write novels about the war on terror, particularly for summer reading. Yeah. Alex Berenson, Daniel Silva are two that come to mind. Do you read any of those, and do you know whether what we should consider their verisimilitude to be well researched?
You know, I have to confess, I rarely read fiction anymore because I'm always researching, and I read the worst stuff. I feel really deprived as a reader, so I can't testify to that. I assume they've done their job.
So, but you're writing a play right now, are you not? I wanted to close by just, everybody might want to know what you're up to next. Are you working on a book? Are you working on a magazine article? You're working on a play, you said.
My editor at The New Yorker asked me to explain Texas. Because
good piece in The New Yorker.
He can't understand why I live there. And so I reminded him I get paid by the word. And that's a big question you just asked. And so we've just published a part of it about our political scene in Texas. And we're going to do another part on oil. But I just kept writing. And so there's a book that'll come out in March. And called God Save Texas. And then we got this television series going on. And but the thing that I'm very excited about is this play that I've been working on since before 9/11. It was 18 years about the making of the movie Cleopatra. And I can see that some of you achieved puberty around the same time I did.
And oh, this is Liz and Dick we're talking about.
Liz and Dick. Young people don't know who Richard... I told my daughter years ago when she was at school that, you know, I'm writing this play and, you know, Richard Burton is one of the characters, not the explorer, the actor, I said. And she said, I don't know either one of them. But this was the most torrid scandal of the 20th century. And what was intriguing to me is they were playing Antony and Cleopatra, the greatest scandal of ancient history. And so there was that doubleness. And so we just finished casting it, and we have a production opening in the Alley Theater in Houston in October. And so that's one of the pets that I've had, you know, in my kennel for a long time, and finally it's got a chance to have an audience.
Well, I think you deserve a break from all the hard work that you've been doing on the
Well, world. I made a resolution years ago that I would only do things that were really important or really fun. And this one is strictly the fun. Yeah.
All right, well, let's put our hands together for Lawrence Wright.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.